and they are still a work in progress. And it's, well, as a lot of my papers are, came out from talking to Lev. And that's also, I'm going to show you some of our last results from the paper. So it's kind of, well, I won't even go in there. Okay, anyway. So I probably should skip a lot of introductory slides. Inflation is basically a good idea. And one of the ways that is interesting that you can probe it is to try to probe how it ended. We know very little about that particular process. The only thing, well, we know that where inflation was going on, it was probably driven by some sort of scalar field homogeneous condensate. And it was a nearly vacuum-like state with just a little bit of quantum excitations, which will later see the structure. So once inflation ends, you have to dump all this energy from homogeneous condensate into the hot Big Bang thermal history of the universe. And how it happens is essentially unknown. You can try to do it perturbatively. That might take a very long time. But interestingly enough, there are mechanisms, again, the seminal papers written by Lev Kaufman, like which provide non-perturbative decay channels. So this is parametric resonance and tachyonic preheatings. Both of the subjects essentially have been nailed by papers by Lev Kaufman. So I'm going to skip a lot of technical details. One of the things we have been doing with Lev, Dick, and Ricci is to take a look at how inflation ends in a particular model of preheating, where you have a quartic inflaton potential which decays into another massless scalar field. I'll just jump to the end result. Is that it turns out there is an observable signal coming out, at least from this simple model. And not only that, it's at observable levels. And not only that, it seems to be reminiscent of actual peculiarities in the data. So what essentially you get from normal inflation is, well, these quantum fluctuations get turned into perturbations of gravitational potential on large scales, which in turn you see as perturbation in temperature of the CMB. Now, there are various non-linear processes involved, for example, the potential of the driving inflation might be curved, non-linear, so there might be second order contributions coming from there. Gravity is non-linear field, and there is all sorts of other smaller non-Gaussianities. So you generally expect to have a little bit of non-Gaussian correction to this Gaussian random field, which was the quantum fluctuations. So if it's all coming from a single field model with local parameterization, the simplest thing to do is you would just write down that non-Gaussian contribution to this gravitational potential you see is whatever the Gaussian random field was generated primordially plus some small coefficient times the square of that field. So that FNL is the FNL parameter WMAP guys like to constrain. In particular, there is a lot of papers by Chiro Kamatsu that does take a look at these things. And right now, the constraints from the data on this coefficient for correlated non-Gaussian content of the field is about, well, it's less than 100 now. So that basically means that the stuff you see in the sky is very, very Gaussian, right? This potential is roughly 10 to the minus 5 in order of magnitude. So the second term is 10 to the minus 5 down from it. So even if you multiply it by 100, it's still tiny, tiny, 10 to the minus 3 non-Gaussianity. Now, what turns out is that, well, the way the inflation adds gets imprinted in this gravitational potential in a very peculiar way. So the dynamics of it non-trivial. You essentially get a brief modulation of equation of state during the history of the universe when you're just going non-homogeneous, when you boil up the vacuum in this parametric resonance process. I don't have time to go into the details about this. But the end result of it is that you generate another component to the gravitational potential perturbation, which is coming from either curvature components originally of the light fields present during this reheating process on which dynamics of it is dependent. But since the process is very resonant and nonlinear, that contribution looks very funny. So you end up with the same inflationary fields present, well, the Gaussian random field. But the nonlinear contribution that comes from the preheating is some nonlinear function of other Gaussian random field. And the function itself is quite peculiar. I sketch it down here. I'll show you a little bit bigger version in a second. But if you look at it, you just notice that it's nowhere close to the quadratic in the parameter region you can sample. And it ends up like having sharp features like peaks and stuff like that. So one of the things that immediately pop up to mind when you think about feature like functions with features when you pipe through the Gaussian random fields is excursion sets, right? So if my function is smooth, I will just have some sort of distorted distribution of a Gaussian random field. If it has a sharp feature, I can hit that magical value of the field and have a sharp feature localized in the space. It will happen when I hit magical values of the field. So if it's a sharp peak, I might end up, you know, with, and it's a rare excursion, I might end up with a contribution to the curvature as nothing, 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 except when you hit this magical field value. Yeah. No, that chi is really not phi. So, and it's either curvature mode. It's a light scalar which was present there, which would be totally irrelevant in the normal inflationary story, but here dynamics depends on it. And that, by the way, it's a good point that Neil mentioned this. This puts actually all the constraints that were down on FNL parameter more or less out of the window, because when you look at the bispectrum for correlated components, you get like, you know, the first contribution pi, pi, pi squared correlator. Right? If the other guy is not correlated with the first, then suddenly this leading order term is not there. So the constraints on this guy, which are people just looking, starting to look at right now, are much more relaxed. So, well, obviously, this guy in absolute magnitude should be smaller than pi, otherwise it would be just sticking out like a sore thumb. But especially if it's localized in space and you're smearing it away in the bispectrum calculation in the whole k modes, then the risk can be substantial contamination, I think, of the uncorrelated non-Gaussianity in there. Just how much remains to be seen, and that has not been looked at very much so far. So anyway, there could be all sorts of interesting contributions in the temperature of the CMB spectrum, which samples the well, gravitational potential of these things. And also gravitational potential, if it has these dips, you would see in the large-scale structure formation, because I have a gravitational potential well. Then stuff will cluster there earlier, so you might end up with bigger objects. So anyway, so we have a simple model, which actually gets quite interesting prediction as far as this function goes. So the amplitude of the effect in this simple model turns out to be exactly the same as amplitude of this contribution from inflation of 10 to the minus 5 order, well, I'm like plus minus a constant, you know, multiplying by constant of order of phi, but of the same order, so potentially observable. Not only that, the sign of the spots you get on the sky are always negative, and that has to do with the dynamics. There is always one-way modulation of the dynamics in the expansion field, which has to do with how effective potential changes during evolution, but the sign always comes up negative. And depending on where you land on this transfer function, you can end up with spot-like structures. So here is a bigger version of this transfer function. It's very spiky, and it has a log periodic structure in the value of that as a curvature component. So you have this light field on top of the inflaton, which has power on all scales because it's light. So it's also exciting during inflation. And what this process doing at the end of the inflation is just samples the value of the field inside the causal patch and assigns the curvature fluctuations according to it. So there is some story of how it happens, but essentially you end up with this thick red line being the transfer function of the field. And if you keep going larger and larger values of the field, it's going to get more and more spiky. So one of the things is that you don't know is how long inflation lasted before the CMB observable scales are. So where you land on that axis is not clear. So you might end up for very small values where this function looks kind of like parabola, and then you just end up uncorrelated quadratic contribution. You might end up somewhere where the parabola has a slope, like here, for example, or here. So you end up with a partially correlated quadratic contribution from Gaussianity. Or maybe you end up in some extreme regime, like something this big. In this case, then you might end up with a spot-like structure on the sky. So let me make a little bit of fake maps to see how this might look like. But most of the time, I want to spend actually talking about how do you go and look out for this kind of things in the data that is, say, like look for the cold spot. So that's just a scale invariant Gaussian noise in two-dimensional realization. So it has, of course, Gaussian field distribution of the values. So what I want to do, well, when I calculate this curvature contribution from reheating is essentially do a point-wise local transformation where I take this value of gravitational potential and pipe it through this nonlinear function. So my nonlinear function looks quite complicated, so I'll just pipe it through the two-peaked Gaussian function like this. And I take intentionally the value where there is quite a bit of overlap between the distribution of the field values and that, like, peak of the function to show you what goes on. So in a sense, it acts as a rectifier. There is cold points and hot points on the original maps. Since the value of the field always points in the same direction, always goes into the same way. And that's primordial thing. So after that, it will get, once plasma in CMB starts sloshing around, it will get all these hydrodynamical transfer functions applied to it. So there is also a line of sight effects. This has to get to us. So I will have to take, if I do it properly, account into account the finite thickness of the last scattering surface and integrated Saxwell ISW effect. I'm not going to bother with this, and just to get your idea of how things look like, just convolve it as a two-dimensional function with a hydrodynamical transfer function like this. So, of course, that does add a little bit of ringing if you close by to every feature of this plot, but especially if you smooth it out to 1 degree scale like WMAP maps are for the plotting purposes, it looks essentially feature for feature what the original transform does. Now, so there is a lot of these guys, and that's clearly non-Gaussian. And if this was on the sky, you would at large amplitude, you would see it. Now, if the excursion of these peaks is rarer and rarer, you get less and less noticeable things. And eventually, if this is rare enough, you just end up with a few of these excursions on the sky. On top of this is, of course, on top of the usual contribution from inflation. So if I just look at the map which has nothing on it, I can quite clearly see that there is, this spot. Bury this in the map which has, thousands of these cold spots of about the same amplitude, and suddenly things is not so clear how you go and try to find it. And what are constraints on these things? In fact, there has been, even since WMAP first year data release, actually, I think even before that, there's been a talk about the cold spot, which appears somewhere here on the CMB map. And one of the things that kind of, got me interested in this is, well, there appears to be some sort of anomaly in the data. So, and we appear to have some sort of anomalous contribution in this theoretical model, which is suspicious of the same order. So I'm not making any rigid claims about, discovery of stuff that's too far in the future. But it's very, I found it very curious. So I decided to go and take a look at the data. And that's what I'm going to talk about today mostly. So that's my take on the infamous cold spot story. And it's been floating around for quite a while. So if you look at it, the best evidence, I think, on the table as of summer of this year, there might be more stuff coming in, which I didn't check when I was teaching this term, is that There is appears to be 1% significance of this cold spot based on kurtosis estimators they have. So probability of having the kurtosis of the point distribution on their filter maps is about 1% from random things. Turns out, and if you just look at the peaks or statistics, it's about 10% probability of being random. Now, once I went out and poked around with some sort of filtering routines, I find significance quite a bit bigger. So right now I'm at the level where it's like 1 in 1,000 random realization would have a chance of having it. So it looks like something is up there. So let me show you the real data, which is a WMAP internal linear combination in the 5-year data release number 3. So I've been playing around mostly with this guy since it already has galaxy kind of masked away. But eventually I would need to go, I will go and take a look at the data by, like, you know, band by band to see what's in there. One of the things that you have to deal with when you're talking about also, like, you know, any sort of non-Gaussianity is galaxy and foregrounds, because that is quite non-Gaussian and obviously non-Gaussian. In fact, there is subtracted point sources in this map, which you don't see by eye, but it's fairly easy to pop away if you try to go and try to do non-Gaussian estimators on this map. So you don't want to use the values of the pixels from contaminated stuff, and that's a mask they use for temperature spectrum analysis. So what the general idea is basically to apply some sort of smoothing filters to this map and take a look which will remove the small scale structure. And take a look if there is something big and prominent sticking out. So if you knew what you're looking for, the best strategy is to cross-correlate with the template of the signal. If you don't want to, if you don't know what you're looking for, you're better off using more generic filters, which will try to attenuate noise down and keep the peak heights as high as possible. So, like, you know, this situation pops up all the time, and here's a slide from my old talk back in the days when I was looking for bursts in the gravitational wave detector data from LIGO, which never got around being published, but I learned a lot of things doing it. And in particular, it translates directly to the problem at hand, right? Except it's, we're looking for the peaks in the two-dimensional noise data. And your two-dimensional noise is your CNB signal. So if you're looking for non-Gaussian spikes, all the CMB stuff people, like, you know, painstakingly extracted is noise for me. But which makes it quite nice, I have very well studied noise when I'm looking for my problem. So what you want to do is you take a combination of mostly noise and maybe a little bit of signal buried in there. Signal is small, otherwise it would have been prominently, like, prominent on the sky. You apply some sort of filter bank to it because you don't know the scale of the thing you're looking for. And then you look for things that stick out, literally, like look for thresholds, excursions. And essentially, the figure of merit of the filter you apply is how much attenuates the peak heights and noise levels. So these are done by essentially two different things. The noise attenuation wave, well, I can write down the exact expressions, but hand wavingly, it's just integral of square of the filter shape. So if I have a filter with a lot of sidebands, it attenuates the noise a lot. The attenuation of the peak is mostly has to do with the central peak of the filter. So trying to optimize this figure of merit, I can come up with more complicated filters. And the guys that looked for this originally, the Spanish group, were used to what they called the wavelet filter or Mexican head shape filter. It's essentially Laplacian of a Gaussian that has a single peak and two extended side lobes going to zero far away, infinitely far away. Now, there is not only this in life. You can play around with, like, you know, a bunch of filters. And the simplest one is to do is just mean average. You take a disk running around circle aperture, and you like, average stuff inside it, and you look for it. This is a notoriously crappy filter. So when Dragan Futterer set out to look for the stuff with this filter, he didn't find anything. So it's bad in two ways. It basically has almost no high frequency attenuation because it has sharp edges. So it just falls off like 1/ω for the frequency things. And it also suboptimal in noise, because it essentially does not have any side lobes to it. So all of it, all of these filter designs, which are essentially like, you know, you're looking for the kernel to convolve this. All of these filter designs is a trade-off between how localized you want to be in the frequency space versus how localized you want to be in the real space, right? So Gaussian in particular is nice, smooth function, which is compact in both, well, kind of compact in both real space and K space. But the passband transition is not really sharp. You know, Fourier image of a Gaussian is a Gaussian, so you have a lot of roll-off in the passbands. So you can do better if you do sine x over x in one dimension, which is a brick wall filter, so just sharp cutoff in the frequency space. But again, when you truncate it to the final size, you'll spoil this perfect cutoff. And in the frequency space, there will be some side lobes. And there is a lot of literature about this because people do this all the time in image, like in image processing, in digital signal processing, in radio, in communications. All of this is like, you know, well known. There are books like this you can go and just take a look at. And optimization of this filter coefficients for pass bands is quite known. So I have my own favorite. Yes. Yes. Well, if I really believe what I'm doing, maybe yes, but but who is going to believe yourself, like yourself if you're serious? If you do this, this at the end of you as a serious.
Well, I mean, the next step is for you to
do. Right. So first of all, I want to know if there is actually anything anomalous in the data, despite the particulars. Then I can take a look at the very, like, you know, good, like, you know, particular models of the data and see if it increases significance. If it does not, well, maybe it's not worth doing it. Maybe it's not a good match. But if I don't have anything, and then suddenly I'm super significant.
My point is, if you can predict this filter from your model,
yeah,
and then you can see how significant is it to find something.
Right.
But the model predicts.
Right, so I want to play with generic filters for now. Eventually, I will get around to doing it. In fact, I know what I'm looking for, so I should be able to do better than just generic filters.
Exactly.
But the question at hand is, like, you know, 10% significance in big statistics is not very significant, right? It's like, you know, fairly random. Is it worth bothering around? Turns out, even with generic filters, you can do much better. That again has to do with, like, you know, well-known filter science stuff. Anyway, so here's my
point. So a not unreasonable approximation is to say that there is a quadratic with the linear offset quadratic ramp and the Gaussian, which you could actually see from the transfer function. So the one of the issues that we're confronted with this is, does that quadratic have enough of a constraint in the data as it is without the rare event aspect? But both would sort of generically be possible features.
But I mean, the other extreme is this basically hard threshold that if you chi is essentially irrelevant until it reaches a particular value and it becomes so it's f.
That's not entirely true because
there is like slow.
But that's one limit. But the other limit is completely this has these fluctuations, right?
Well, there is a, like, quadratic ramp up leading to the peak, so there is going to be a little bit of, like, you know, quadratic longitudinal leading to it as well. Like right there. So it looks different contribution. But anyway, okay. So if you have a model, you can go out and look for it. So I'm just now, I'm actually, well, kind of got curious to the data. This is, by the way, the first time I ever do remotely anything related to real data.
But my point is just that you can randomly produce in your model how traffics look like.
Well, I can bootstrap and I can, like, you know, get like average shape of this peak. I can do a lot of things with this. The question is, do I really want to be that particular?
Well, you have a model, you want to test it. So
right. Exactly. No, I just first of all, before testing anything, I can I want to know if there is, like, you know, subject to discussion at all. Right. So. One particular family of filters which I like and I tend to play around with are polynomial filters, which are known as Savitsky-Galay filters. So these are actually, like, you know, the top site number one paper in analytical chemistry. So this is the filters like the guys use for extracting spectral lines from spectra when they do, like, chemical observations, like, you know, line spectroscopy. And apparently, it turns out, it's not very well known otherwise of that, except it's in numerical recipes where I get all my numerical knowledge from. Anyway, so these are polynomial filters, and they are designed to be orthogonal to polynomials up to order n on the interval in the original, you know, one-dimensional version. Or for me, that would be on a disk. And I also do a little bit of generalization by adding up a smoothing window function, which is a function of certain order which falls off, so that the tails of this filter fall off of order as of order k. And well, I'm orthogonal to nth order. So the filter coefficients you can just figure out by writing down normalization and orthogonality conditions. You're orthogonal to all the polynomials up to order n, which gets enough coefficients to figure out what these filters are. And they kind of look like this. You know, this zeroth order filter, like zero, zero order filter, is just top half. You just get one. You know, if you add some smoothing to the second order, it will look like a bell shape, which is just a parabola. In fact, this function is 1 minus x squared squared. So it starts out from zero smoothly, goes to a quadratic peak. Now, if I add more and more power, like coefficients in there, what we get basically for every power in this expansion series, you get a node. So if I get like, you know, this 4-2 power polynomial filter, it will have four zeros and fall off like square at the edges. And these are design filters. You can put it in any order. For example, more complicated ones would be like eighth order filter with fourth order smoothing at the edges. So it will have eight zeros. And like the side lobes will tail off really smoothly. So you can play around with these guys. So one of the advantages of these guys, and that's why they were designed for the spectroscopy, since they are orthogonal to the polynomials of nth order, they will pass a peak which has an expansion, like, you know, up to nth order of the polynomial, completely unattenuated. But they have side lobes, so if there is random stuff, they will attenuate that. So they do a little bit better. For example, if you just take a top hat filter and try to pass a parabola through it, you'll end up with, again, a parabola, but negative constant, so it will try to bring it down, it will aliase it down. So these guys will not. So that's, in essence, why they're so useful in trying to extract sticking out features from the data. So what I need to do is I need to take this mask, take this map, mask it, and run this filter. So I sat down at some point when I was at CETA visiting in August and just wrote down the brute force convolution program. It just does n square operation on the map. It's slow as hell, but it's serviceable. And you can take a look at the output. So nothing fancy there. So what I'm going to show you is the results for these three filters. I'll color code them, already shown in the previous page. They essentially all look the same in the central, like, you know, peak, if you normalize them for the same heads and same full width half maximum. And the only thing different is just what the side lobes are doing. The higher the order of the filter, the more extended side lobes, and the smoother they are attached to zero. So these three guys are, like, you know, SSG02, 42, and 84 order filters. And you can kind of look at them, like, you know, the very first one kind of looks like Gaussian, except it truncates faster than doesn't have these Gaussian tails, which actually makes it easier because then I don't have, like, only have to have, like, finite size, window running around on the convolution, which makes it faster and also makes the contribution of faraway pixels more controlled. So, and then you go, apply this to your map, and you'll go look for peaks. And the peak statistics is well known, again, by somebody from CETA. That's the formula written by Dick about, what, 20 years ago now. So that's the statistics of the peaks of the two-dimensional Gaussian random field. This is the probability to have a peak at an excursion level higher than something. Essentially has a three parameters in it. Well, the usual mean and the RMS of the study, like, of the distribution, and also parameter gamma, which has to do with how the two moments are. What are the moments of the distributions? Right. So I think it's gamma zero times sigma zero times sigma two divided by sigma one squared, something like this. Now, you can go. Take this map, filter it with this kernel, extract the peaks, which is like, you know, stock routine in QPix extractor, and take a look at how the statistics applies to these peaks. So then you would know the distribution of the map. And this is how it looks like with 1 degree radius PIM on the sky. So there is lots of peaks. There is about, like, you know, 4,000 peaks at these filtered scales in the CMB map. You can go and plot their distributions. That's a cumulative density function. And you can overlay, like, you know, fit and overlay the distribution from the formula you expect from the Gaussian fit. And you go and look at it, and it looks very much like what you would expect as a Gaussian thing. And in fact, you can look how much this distribution is different from the one you expect from this Gaussian peak statistics. That's Kolmogorov, essentially, Smirnov test. So what you do is you take cumulative density function, take a look at how it is different for the given percentile level, and take a look if this gets more than square root of n, then you exclude that's a different distribution. So what upper panel shows is this Kolmogorov-Smirnov deviation statistics for all these points. And if it gets outside of the pink bands, then it becomes statistically significant. So the bands are, I think, this one is 99.7%, that this one is 95%, and the one you barely see, or probably not see at all, that 68% confidence limits. So if you just take a smooth CMB map, it looks very much like there are peaks extracted from a Gaussian random field distribution there. Now, and you can go and vary the filter shape, and you'll get less and less and less and less and less peaks. So I'm jumping a little bit up ahead. I did something to this map. So you actually ended up with this prominent feature already visible in it. But that's jumping a little bit up ahead. OK, so if you do this and you run up just the apply these three filters on the map which I've shown you before, you end up with pretty insignificant detection of stuff. So you end up, you know, for the most part, you extract some peaks, and the statistics are something like of order not even 1 sigma. So that's basically in line with, you know, 10% peak detection figure Spanish guys were doing. Now, but I'm not exploiting all I know about the problem. And by the way, these guys, like, you know, the points are color-coded according to the filter, and they're also color-coded according to the spot you pick up. Like, you know, square is the most, like, you know, most detectable spot. And right now, it's not significant at all, so don't pay attention to the shapes of the points just now. So what I did not exploit at all is the knowledge of my CMB noise, right? I know my CMB statistics very, very, very well, right? People spend like a lot of time and effort doing this. So in fact, I can exploit it. If I know the noise, I can do much more optimal detection of it. And depending on what your model is for the signal, you can do essentially optimal filter, Wiener filtering. So the model of these linear type filters is basically this. You take a signal, you convolve it with some function, and add the noise. So the optimal transfer function to extract the signal is, well, something like which is signal divided by signal plus noise powers. And one of the over the convolution kernel you apply to the signal in the first thing. So assuming that the signal got convolved with the same transfer function as a CMB, then the best thing to do is provide on the data, apply 1/√ of CMB power. Assuming the signal is laying on top of CMB, which has a noise power and it's small, the best thing to do is apply to it weight of 1/ CMB power, so the different power laws. And I know the spectrum very well, both from just calculating CLs from the map I see, and also have the lambda CDM model, which gets me very smooth spectrum, which I know quite well. So this is what happens if I apply lambda CDM, like very smooth spectrum, downweight all these bands where the CMB is prominent, and just provide the data using CMB. Suddenly, all of a sudden, I get a very significant detection on all the filters. And by the way, in two scales. There is one cold spot of about, like, you know, 5 degree diameter. There is another one at about 14 degrees, which both filters pick up. So the reason I did try Lambda CDM model, like, you know, spectrum first, is that I didn't really want to deal with contamination of the spectrum estimates from potentially bad pixels on the map. If I am willing to get into this discussion and calculate CLs from the map itself, it goes even way more significant. And sorry, by the time this talk was written, this was still writing, like, you know, calculating stuff, because n squared at large degrees takes a lot of effort. So essentially, it's how I evaluate the spectrum of the data, spectrum of CMB noise. If I take the spectrum of CMB noise to be Lambda CDM model, that is essentially this result. If I take data, just calculate CLs from the data, it's this. Now, this is the high Ls, they are very similar, the two things, right? The only difference is, like, you know, in a lower Ls, but I'm hoping to be looking for the features of about, like, you know, 10 and 20 degrees on scale, so it makes a bit of a difference. Now,
is that you get contamination of the large-scale Gaussian thing, and it's best to get rid of it. And that's what optimal indicators always do for you. Mm-hmm. They try and get rid of it, and they try and go into this space. And so it's the natural space to operate in.
Right. So if I do, so if I do this, I can, well, at this scale of about like 12 to 14 degrees diameter, full width half max things. So the probability of having the random realization with the peak of that scale, which is taken out of the data, is less than 10 to the minus 3. So the peak itself actually is 5 sigma from the distribution, but there is about 150 of them. So that gets you this 10 to the minus 3 probabilities. And there are points which fall off, like, you know, below here. A few of them are, like, you know, at significance 1 in 2,000 random realization probability, something like this. And, well, one of the things that, you know, you might ask, well, you did a lot of filter sizes, like, you know, to get to this. But actually, if you look at it, so shouldn't you be marginalizing over stuff? But really, there is only essentially the filters, like, at neighboring sizes are very, very correlated. So essentially, there is only, like, you know, two independent detections here. Here is, like, one fault spot made by squares. Here's another one. And they cross over. So if you take, like, you know, bootstrap the data, put a peak in, and just run it, and you ask myself, what is the height of the peak according to the filter, you always end up with this shape. Like, you know, you ramp up to optimal size and you come down. So in fact, if you have, like, you know, one big feature, it will trail down, you know, like in exactly the same filter, well, the same shape as it kind of goes down, then goes back up. So I will, of course, take a look at the marginalized statistics of this. But essentially, my feel it as of moment is that, like, the most significant detection is pretty much gives you a good idea of how significance is going to turn out. Because it essentially, like, you know, this minimum of this curve determines the whole curve. So if you see more of it, it's not going to change significance too much. Now, so observation number one, there is quite prominent cold spot. And it's much more prominent than people originally thought. So significance is now, like, you know, order of magnitude more than the Courtois estimators. And there is also subdominant, like, you know, smaller cold spot, which is, by the way, happens at about like 1 in 100 estimate. So it's off also in the southern hemisphere. And I know where these two things are. Now, one of the curious enough things, when I'm looking for the most prominent guys. So there is like one whopping peak, and there is like smaller peak. There is, of course, smaller things, but they become less and less significant. In fact, there is, like, you know, some smaller scale stuff which has a lot of things that pick up.
But all of that is just due to one.
So all of the things, like, you know, all of this is due to one spot, and all of this is due to another one. So now, the very interesting question that bothers me, because I have a vested interest in the model which I'm trying to look at, is this peak coming from primordial stuff, or is it coming from some foreground things? Now, the best way to do it is to try to figure out what the polarization is doing, because if it's in gravitational potential, the polarization in the E mode will be gradient of Z. Now, and if it's something foreground like Neil's texture, then it won't do anything to polarization.
But that
will be
completely different signature.
Yeah, completely different, signature. Right?
Yeah. That's
so, yep. So that's the point. It's very easy to distinguish these two things, it's worth doing. Mm-hmm. So right now there is a polarization data available. So one of the things I'm going to do out here is I'm going to teach to catch Mike and torture him until he confesses how they store it. Of course, the Planck is also out and we're going to have much better polarization data. I might be able to even say something about even from WMAP data. It's like, after all, I'm looking at it like 10 degree things, so I average things a lot. So maybe it's okay if I just look at it. But anyway, nobody looked for this, so.
The interesting point is the weighting may help.
Yes.
What's happened is that, WMAP is great for the polarization.
Yeah.
And so it may well be that with the appropriate weighting, you can draw more.
Right. So I'm just looking for. Yeah. Nobody tried it. Nobody knows how hard it is, and if we're going to do any sort of useful things. But it's a good thing to do, and just start thinking along the lines of sight of what we would do. Now, if it's primordial spot, then you can also try to see whether I get better significance by assuming it's primordial, or whether assuming it's overlay. As I said, the best optimal filter to do on the overlay is to try to divide not by the, not pre-weight on the noise, but to divide by the power, so it downweights the peaks. And if I do this in the actual data, I get less significance. So that's maybe indicative of something. By the way, I do still have quite significant detections of these things, and you can clearly see these two hot, like cold spots. But a little bit of less than assuming that the signal piped through the same transfer function as the CMB noise. Now, that might mean something, that might not, but it's curious. I think it's very worthwhile to take a look at the polarization data. Yes. And as usual, being over. So that's essentially the punchline. So that's the same plot with the statistics of the peaks for the most significant, one of the most typical, most significant filter hit. It's the one which comes with significance about 1 in 1100. So you end up with a bunch of peaks which lie around all between plus minus three sigma distribution. And then you get one outlier point sticking out here at 5 sigma out from the peak. And it's very, very quick nuclear. You look at it, it's separated. There is nothing even close to it. So you can evaluate the shapes of this fit, so you extract the sigma and gamma parameters of the distribution. It's offset from zero because it's cut out from it, so it's not averaged to zero. And it's still fitting fairly well as far as distribution goes. Once you get less and less peaks and bigger cut out of the plane, you might end up into trouble eventually, but it looks okay as of now. So I can evaluate the statistics, and that's how we evaluate the significance.
Quick question, which maybe we could do offline, but one of the issues was spillover from the complex mask.
Yep.
And an easy way to check that is actually to lay down Gaussian random field and then put the mask on and then do the operation and then just see what happens. I don't know.
Right. So I haven't tried that. And in fact, I also want to just, one of the things is that when I calculate my spectra and when I pre-weight on the data, I do these Fourier things, right? It mixes up all the pixels, particularly bad ones. I think at some point I'll just give up and do a square convolution of the mask data with brute force convolver to pre-weight on it, because I only need to do it once, so I don't care how expensive it is. But then I will be absolutely sure that I don't get any contamination from these things. It looks okay because an actual cold spot, which is here, is way away from all this bad stuff. But it's with this filtered map, it's essentially to the point where you don't need to have statistics. It's literally much darker in color than anything else on the map. So this is even chi by I already works on here.
It's where is the second one?
Second one, I think, is around here. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the maps made up. I didn't, all of this was happening within the last 10 hours, as usual.
Okay. So where? I'm not sure. Clouds are just above that.
So I think there is stuff around here somewhere, but.
I'm just wondering if this is in the Magellanic Stream, where you have a big plume of disturbed gas sort of in the galaxy.
As if
you said the two spots are lined up together, it'd be interesting to see where they lie on the sky on the Magellanic Stream.
So being non-astronomer, I have no idea where stuff is on the sky. That's
the I mean, so, I don't know whether it has any spectral signature.
Spanish group claim it has a thermal.
It is a thermal spectrum. Yeah.
At least in three frequencies of W.
So where's your hotspot on that blue light?
This is my cold spot.
That's
a cold spot.
So the LMC is just up to the left.
Yeah. So one of the other things about this, well, maybe. Yeah, I'll leave it there. You can play around with more stuff about it. But yeah, it's basically pretty much picking up a large signal here. So it's literally sticking out a lot.
Presumably, the Magellanic Stream would give a rather different signal than this sort of thing.
Okay.
It's a characteristic scale, and it's separated from.
Okay, since I'm
but that's a very, very fair comment that's worthwhile exploring. That is to say, how much of the beautiful CMB might have some interesting things that are coming from things that not just Magellanic Stream distance, but also solar system distance.
Yes.
It's still, in my view, there's still a lot to further explore.
That's true. I don't know where the ecliptic is on this.
So ecliptic. It goes like this. It's like the axis of Willow. That's the only thing I know. But anyway, I'm also itching to say something very speculative. Okay, I'll do it. So assuming that this primordial spot is primordial, it actually can account for other things like north-south asymmetry. Remember, like, you know, people have been saying that like there is a dipolar contribution to more power in the thing. If this was overlaying on top of the signal, that would like distort the spectrum. But if it's coming through the same hydro contribution, it will just change normalization of the spectrum. So if I have one primordial cold spot in one of the hemispheres, but not in the other one, I'll have more power there simply because I just have a picture drawn on there. And that I think we realized from when we were playing around with this model around. But Neil Barney just emailed me that the paper came out saying that again from the Spanish group saying that they actually can they taken a look at it and they say that it's about it can account for about 60% of the.
But they've been saying that for a long time, actually.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was on the table for.
This was on the table, except I didn't read any of this paper, so it was bona fide prediction about the sign of the effect, right? It has to be more power in the same, in the southern hemisphere.
But the interesting thing is with better optimal weighting techniques, I'm sure that one can actually hit this harder.
Right. So yeah. So as I said, this optimal, just taking the only thing I really did, filter shaping and stuff like that, whatever, does maybe some gain, but just accounting for the CMB spectrum gets you totally better shape in peak statistics alone. If I do cross-torsions on it, I might gain some more as well. So that alone is that's where the strength of this is. So yeah.
Good to see inflation ruled out.
Maybe it's a texture
resistance.
Maybe it's a texture, and maybe this confirms the inflation.
So this has no spectral signature, just thermal.
So if it's primordial, it's just a temperature distortion. So it will be thermal with a little bit of temperature distortion.
Have you looked at different frequencies?
I have not looked at it. One of the reasons is I have to be really careful about subtracting the galaxy, which is still hanging around at these maps.
So you just use the highest frequency?
So I just use LC map, which is mostly the lowest noisy map everywhere except for the galaxy. In fact, it's clearly has non Gaussian transition band where the linear combination changes when you go inside the galaxy. So
in an ideal situation, you would also be including the complicated noise correlation matrix.
Yeah. But
on these scales, the idea is that your cosmic variance limited times. Where the noise is not relevant, but complex subtractions of foregrounds do lead to effective correlations.
So when I'm in the tricky position where I need to cut you off, but I also have questions I want to ask.
Go for it.
I'm going to compromise and only ask maybe one of my questions, which is so the polarization test to distinguish between two wavelengths, that would make sense to any of
you? Sure.
Well,
okay. Since that was so quick, I want
to. Will be email. So ACTS will be able to look at this region of the sky, and the real conclusive test that it's a texture will be that you will measure the lensing, if it is along the line of sight, it would lens the pattern of CMB.
It's
actually, you don't need polarization, just do the CMB.
So it will be mostly in B mode around this, right? But you know, just...
If, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so then very easy to tell apart, like, you
yes.
know, gradient, upper...
That's cool.
Okay, excellent.
So you just look in the high L CMB, and you should be, I mean, I estimated how many sigma, it should be like 1,000 sigma.
Okay, so then that would be blending rovers, which is a good thing.
So while Gigi is setting up, I maybe should say that, so for lunch, I have vouchers for everybody, so please, you know, when they come around and ask to pay for lunch, just go and them a voucher. But in order to do that, you have to get them for me after the stop, or you go to lunch.